huge amount of responses, probably millions by now, being touched by mindfulness in a way that they wouldn't have been otherwise. I learned everything I know about mindfulness from this guy. And so, you know, my main mistake is just blaming him. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really, really pleased to welcome John Pavlik. Something a little bit different from a coffee break, and you can have coffee breaks for the rest of your life, at least.
but that actually you incorporate mindfulness into it moment by moment, as best you can, without it being imposed or strained or artificial or contrived. But that would be the challenge, that we see this entire time as kind of like a retreat, or maybe we should use the word retreat, mindfulness retreat, but more like, if you will, an advance, or maybe we don't need to say advance, but maybe an opening into the embodied experiencing of life unfolding. So then whatever happens becomes the curriculum. Whatever happens. And I'll say more about that towards the end. But in terms of going to the bathroom, for instance, there will not be bathroom breaks. I'm told that there's something like 250 people in the room. And a bathroom break at the same time would be a catastrophe. Especially on the women's side. So when you need to go to the bathroom, go to the bathroom mindfully, come back mindfully, and consider that if you do that, even though you may miss what's going on in the hall, you're following the true curriculum. There will be natural break points, not breaks, but transition points where it might make more sense to go to the bathroom than to say in the middle of the body scan. So when we get to the bladder, you all So a few more sort of help orientations for me. How many of you are psychotherapists or work with people using cognitive therapy? Raise your hand. Wow. And how many of you do other work of that kind, in some way or other, professionally related to this whole enterprise of mindfulness? Just raise your hands. Okay, and now everybody, like just the whole group, professionals related to this business. Raise your hands. And then those of you who are just in the community and care about this and wanted to come, raise your hand. Wonderful. So welcome one and welcome all. And ultimately, as I said last night, or at least hinted at last night, everybody's here for a reason that has an element of mystery to it. And I hope you recognize that in yourself. That you may have 100 different reasons why you're here, and none of them may be the truest reason why you're here. So entertain the possibility that whatever got you here has an element of both mystery and importance to it. And let's just see if we can honor that and enter into this without too many expectations, like what demands, like I want it to be this because on Monday I'm going to start teaching this and I need to know this, this, and this. If that's the case, if that happens to be the case, then just notice how strong the expectations are. Require a certain kind of information. I want to say this is not about information. This is, in some sense, more about wisdom than it is about knowledge. And that has something to do with it. It's not that knowledge and information is not incredibly important, but the synthesizing of it, the embodying of it, the deep standing underneath it, which we call understanding, is actually a prerequisite for doing this work. None of us are really that good at it or capable of that. So it's very humbling. And as long as we stay honest with ourselves about it and don't try to sort of inflate ourselves into some kind of, you know, meditative propaganda around how wise we are, or how calm we are, or how centered we are, or how clear we are, and create a big story about my spiritual advancement, you're in good shape. If you notice any kind of taint coming along from that time, yes, I am the queen of mindfulness. best and what's beautiful in you, and which the world really, 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 really needs. And it doesn't need you to be in some kind of simulated state of mindfulness. It needs you to own the actuality of your experience, and a lot of times it's not pleasant, and it's not pretty. And I want to sort of just establish that from the very beginning, because whatever comes up over the next 2 days, given that, you know, we have 250 people in the room, 250 bodies, 250, you could say, minds, but there's so much going on within any one mind that, you know, you could have like the whole platoon in there, pulling in different directions, or having different opinions and ideas about what's important. You know what I'm talking about? And various kinds of emotional states that come and go, and that really sometimes feel like they have a grip on your throat. All of that is part of the weekend. Not if it's like, oh, I'd be a great meditator if it weren't for what's happening right now. You know, if I weren't so whatever. No, it's not about the content. It's never, and I'll just say this right off the bat, it's never about the objects of attention. The objects of attention are sweet, important, tremendous information in them, tremendous value to attending to them over a long period of time, but it's in the real importance is in the faculty of attending, not so much whether it's the breath or body sensations or emotional turbulence. And so if over the course of these 2 days you run into a period of emotional turbulence, by all means, remember to put out the welcome mat for it. It's not like, oh, I'd be having a great workshop except this came up. Hear what I'm saying? That's the curriculum for you at that point. And if you feel a lot of agony, well, you probably know this already. I mean, it's just part and parcel of being alive. I mean, we can't allow ourselves to actually open to it and bring the embrace of mindfulness and self-compassion to it. Then, you know, we probably should be someplace else for the next 2 days. It might be sort of wasting your time. So the cardinal invitation is kindness. And the kind of acceptance of what emerges, not as passive resignation and defeat, or to have some any kind of cognitive orientation to it at all, but just the opposite. To let go of all the cognitive, the, you know, sort of scaffolding, so to speak, and just allow us, us for these two very, very precious days, which will be over before you know it, to speak to you in a kind of original way. Like if there's sadness, see if you can get inside the feeling in the body. And so another hint is whenever you get disoriented, see if you can come back to the body. And if you don't feel the body's trustworthy, then notice that you don't feel the body's trustworthy, and then trust that that thought may not be so accurate. See if you can find some way to be in relationship to your body that's at least tentatively affectionate. Can you all hear me, by the way?
Yeah.
And can you all see me well enough? I know I'm maybe I need another one that needs to get up a little higher, but I don't think that's going to happen. Are you okay with this? You don't actually need to see me today. And it's not about me. And at a certain point, we'll be lying down on the floor and we'll be looking up at the ceiling. So it's not about me. It's important that you can hear me. And the title of this, just so that, are there any questions right off the bat, or any concerns or worries or anything that you want to voice? And let me just ask a question that I asked. I said, how many of you come from more than 50 miles away? Look around. Because none of us really know what's going on. You know, somehow the word got put out that this was going to happen. And then people appear. And the people turns out to be us. There are probably at least as many people who almost appeared. I mean, and they tell me, actually, that there's a long waiting list. So, like, probably at least as many. circus. It can be done. I've done it for thousands of people, you know. But it felt like a certain kind of intimacy. You say, well, 250 people out of the things can be done. Very difficult. Because the intimacy isn't really between you and me. The intimacy is between you and me. Each one of us into becoming in a sense or inviting ourselves to become a little bit more intimate with the actuality of our experience. And to a certain extent, although I will talk a little bit about outcomes and about process and everything, for the rest of the time after that, it would be good to let go of all of that stuff and just allow your experience to be what it is. This is, in some sense, a direct, this is called, what did I call it? Mindfulness in medicine and psychology, a first-hand taste. Okay? So without the first-hand taste, it's all just talk. It's all just stuff, thinking, theory, which here doesn't really. It's very important, but it's a framework that requires embodied understanding and practice. By practice, we don't mean rehearsal. This is not like practicing the violin or the piano for someone's performance or someone's practice, and the performance is life control. There's no performing. It's not performing. So because you're all therapists and probably use this term a lot, I will get another thing sort of off my chest immediately, and that is to suggest that to a, you know, at least in the 99% time, you throw out the word modeling from your vocabulary. Okay? If you're modeling something for a patient or for somebody else, it has too much of a connotation of an act. You're acting something. And let's replace it with embodying. Okay, so this is not about faking being mindful or faking being calm, sort of giving the person the outer sense of how that would be, because it's much too deep and also mysterious for that. The real challenge is, can we practice in a way that is completely authentic and true to the present moment, so that we neither push anything away nor pursuing anything at all, mental constructs, mental models, schemes, or anything for these 2 days? Is that going to be challenging? Of course, because everything in our lives is going to reinforce our samurai skill of thinking, of being really good thinkers. And so to a large degree, we're often inflated by our thoughts and the emotions that, you know, go along with them very much of the time. Those of you who understand mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and the kind of cognitive processing and emotional processing that's involved in depressive rumination, spirals of depressive rumination, understand that thinking, has, especially habituated conditioned patterns of thought have tremendous power to actually accrue a whole range of other potential possibilities for us. Capacities that we already own that are innate to us, but that are not available when we fall into those kinds of modes of automaticity. And so this is really an opportunity for you to understand that, even if you've sat 100 retreats already. And let me just get a sense of how many of you have never sat a 10-day meditation retreat in silence? Raise your hands. Now I know why I can't. Okay. This is not going to be 10 days, but to a large degree, this is very, very challenging next step, if you will, in befriending yourself. Because when all is said and done, in order to embody mindfulness in the world, one needs to actually exercise the muscles that allow us to be present in the only moment that we ever have, in a way that has integrity and is not freighted with all of the likings and dislikings and opinions and judgments that we carry around like crazy, that are sometimes so passive that we don't even know that they are framing and coloring virtually everything we see in the media. And so to just let that be, not push it away, letting go means letting it be, not making it go. But, and then bringing a bigger embrace to it, embrace of awareness. It's a capacity that we already have. We're giving ourselves the potential to actually understand our own experience and see the options that are provided to us moment by moment, or saying why to us moment by moment by moment, that may be completely opaque to us because we are so highly conditioned. And so the simpler we can get today, the better. I'm not even at a loss, even though I said that I would describe all the background and work of mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and I'm at a loss for whether to even do it, because I don't want to sort of set up the wrong tonal quality that we're going to have to transition out of. Ultimately, when you've been practicing for a long time, there's no such thing as there's the practice and then there's everything else. There's no such thing as everything else. Life is the practice. Thinking is the practice. Feeling, emotions, everything is practice, but it requires awareness. It requires mindfulness. And that's a muscle. We're not very, very practiced at. So our awareness is very haphazard, and it's very sort of self-serving in a certain kind of way. We're aware when we want to be. We don't want to be, we don't hear, we don't see, we don't smell, we don't taste, we don't connect. You know what I'm talking about, by the way? And just because you're a therapist doesn't immunize you from that kind of logisticity or mechanical, mode of mind. What, sometimes called the doing mode of mind. It's always about blasting through our moments to get to some better moment, more desirable, where we can say, that's what I'm in this for. And missing it. So I guess what I'll do is first invite us to drop into stillness for a few moments. Is there anybody who's brand new to meditation, formal meditation, like never had any instruction in formal meditation before and never engaged? Raise your hand. And don't be shy about it. You guys have the most privileged position in the house. Okay? It won't last too long, but wonderful. Because you're in possession for the next few minutes of what is called in the Zen tradition beginner's mind. So that means you have the potential to come to it like open and receptive and just available. Of course, it's probably not true because there are like a million ideas and opinions about meditation. You probably go wrong. And so, but still, well, the rest of you are somewhere in between having maybe many, many years of extended silent retreats, which is not necessarily wonderful or privileged, to no silent retreats, as we saw the hands for that, to never had any experience of formal meditation practice at all. So now we're in some sense all on the same page. It's not about the past. So what it is, and it's not about the future, or where we'll go, or how great it will be. Are any of you cold, by the way?
Yeah.
Is the temperature in the room okay? Good, okay. So, we have... quite cold at the back? How are we doing? Is the temperature, Mike, has the temperature gotten up to where you said it, or not?
It's currently 17 degrees. If you set it at the back, you get a slight down, well.
Okay, so it's 73?
It's 70.
70? Oh, I'm just happy you used Fahrenheit. You're warmer already. Why don't you put it at 72? Something like that. Okay. So if it's all about the present moment, we're all on the same page already, because it's only now. The only moment we're ever alive. So basically the invitation is going to be to put aside aside everything that you hope for and like all the schemes and plans and worries about the future and see if we can actually inhabit this moment. So this will be very short by the clock, still an infinite number of moments, since moments are at least approximately, that's a whole other conversation we're going to have today, approximately infinitesimal. Sit in a posture, since you're sitting, in a posture that embodies wakefulness, embodies presence, embodies dignity. And see if you can bring awareness to the feeling of the body in the posture that you adopted. Motion within the body that's keeping us alive. So let's see if we can just, without the cognitive overlay, just experience the breath coming in and out of the body. quality of your attention in this moment? Is there some degree of struggle? Are the sensations difficult to discern? Is there an element of unpleasantness in the whole experience? If so, can that be located in the body? What is the quality in the heart in this moment, in what we could call the metaphorical heart? In other words, how do you feel in the world in this moment? Restless? Bored, all of which, any of which, would be fine. But see if you can know in this moment, just take a peek. How are you feeling in this moment? As the breath moves in and out of the body, as the body sits here. Again, is there any element of forcing or straining or striving? Is there any element of strain? Any element of wanting? Fill the mind with anything, but to just discern what's here in the mind, this moment, how it is in the mind, how it is in the heart, how it is in the body. And to notice that you have a genius for this moment. You know instantly, without thinking. How you are in this moment in relationship to stillness. In relationship to silence. Inviting yourself to take a slow, deep, more intentional, and perhaps even delicious breath in. And all the way down into the pelvis, so to speak, letting it sort of bottom out in the pelvis and top off in the apices of the lungs behind the collarbones, and just holding the breath in. One big, gigantic embrace of breath. dialogue and input. Although we don't have a lot of microphones, we have one handheld mic and two mics of this size. If anybody would like to comment or report on their experience of this very exploration, whether you ran into meditation, you've been meditating for 50 years, if there's anything that struck you as particularly salient, interesting, challenging, problematic, it might be really valuable to actually give voice to.
Difficult speed. I'm very moved and I'm weeping. I don't know why, but I know that I'm weeping. I'm very aware of my body. I'm noticing this pain in my heart and a lot of tension in my head or my mind. And I can hear that I'm breathless, which I didn't know since speaking up.
Well, thank you very much for just the courage that it takes to stand up in front of 250 people say anything and to actually be honest. And for that to be not just okay, but from the sense of it, from my perspective, more than okay. It's like a perfect thing, because that's your experience in this moment. And I would like to ask you a question, if you take the microphone back there, and that is just tuning in right now in this moment. Even though there, if I understood you correctly, there's a sense of a bit of agitation. Is your awareness of the agitation agitated?
No.
You find that an interesting observation?
Yeah, it gives me perspective.
Does it give you something more than perspective? Take your time, because I'm not asking you to think about it, but to actually explore it, experiment with it.
Yeah, I can feel my shoulders are relaxing. My body's relaxing into that.
Okay, so even as you hold the tension, if you will, in awareness, something shifts.
Yes.
Okay. So you have a larger perspective on something that might be turbulent, uncomfortable, or unpleasant, and very familiar.
Indeed.
And is there a sense of, in the feeling of the shoulders dropping, a sense of other ways to be in relationship to what's unfolding in the present moment?
My sense is that I'm in a more true stance. I can feel it in my body, that my body, I'm standing differently. So it actually feels like I'm leaning backwards, but my sense is that the truth is that I'm standing more upright.
And does it feel trustworthy?
Yes, I feel like I'm more plugged into the earth or something. That my feet are kind of going down.
Anchored.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else?
I'm I'm still feeling very moved, somehow privileged to know that something is okay.
Sorry.
Something is okay. Yes, it's true that I've realised it just now, and I'm also aware that I have realised it before and I've forgotten.
That's more interesting. How many people can relate to this? This is a very important principle, by the way, because we think we're so unique in the story of these, of course, the most important story in the world, featured on all the marquees. But actually, we have a tremendous amount in common in terms of how we negotiate our experience from moment to moment in all sorts of different domains, like the thinking domain, emotional domain, somatic domain. So there's this element of forgetting. It's something you already know. Relevant to or do it in that you think, get me the hell out of here now. I would get over there to at the door at a location. I should have sat there. I should have been there. Get me out of here. I'm not looking for testimonials. Oh, yes, my mind fell open. You know, my mind fell open. You know, the angels descended.
I'm Richard Latham. Really enjoyed the meditation then, and last night, that's the first time I've actually enjoyed, as you just described, delicious breathing. A strange experience I had was, well, it's not strange at all, I guess, it was a sense that, of awareness, and then a realization that my story was being moved through my body, and maybe I wasn't who I thought I was. Then, as you said, to follow, I was striving for something, and yes, I was, and I left that. And then there was a sense of that maybe I wasn't anything, but I was an awareness living through my body. So the point, I guess, I was intrigued me was I actually shied away from it. So I sensed something quite
hard. Shied away from what?
The sensation of something quite wonderful, really. I wouldn't use these words, but some people might call it a life force or something, a sense of awareness. But I felt it for a moment.
It's interesting that you wouldn't use those words.
I just did this.
If I mirror that back to you, whoever said I wouldn't use those words,
but
it's, yeah. It's an example of how there's a whole platoon of eyes in there, and one of them managed to get those words out.
So I sensed it for a moment, it really was quite wonderful, but there was a sense of myself not being there, and I found myself something inside being shut away from it and deliberately left the meditation to some extent.
At that point?
Yeah, and then immediately I was intrigued to try and return to that. And that came from really my first experience of successfully meditating with breath under the guidance.
Thank you. wouldn't you say?
Yeah, very interesting.
If someone else followed that out of their experience, would you say, yeah, wow, interesting. On a lot of different levels. So, I find it very interesting myself. One of the things that I find interesting is how we identify with certain modes of seeing or feeling. And you say, well, that's me, but that's not. Okay? And I shouldn't go there because if I do, if I go there, whoever's speaking, if I go there, it won't be me. Maybe I'll lose me. Maybe I'll lose my mind. I'll feel really good, and you know, that happened to Odysseus, and he got stuck on an island for 10 years. So I don't want to, like, you know, not be able to go to work tomorrow or Monday, and as I go, how was that meditation? Jesus, I'm just like that. You know, and that's the kind of fear, like, I won't be able to be my sharp self, you know, or I won't be able to, so maybe I'll get too fluffy. I'll get too, oh, yeah. Whatever we caricature it as being, don't give up the microphone just yet. You said something about I had my first successful meditation. Did you say that?
Yes, I think so.
So I'm interested in the successful part.
I've tried breathing meditation before, and found it extremely boring. But actually, breathing meditation, when it works, the air can, as you described, taste delicious. And with that, with the eyes.
Well, let's not generalize it. In this morning, as you were breathing in this air that doesn't have the slightest relationship to the outside, you found it delicious. Yes. In between, presumably, a number of breaths are folded. You're going after that successful meditation. And the reason I'm playing around in this kind of way is because this work of cultivating awareness is, if you'll excuse me putting it this way, deadly serious. I mean, it's about life and death. It's about the fact that we may be missing large swaths of our own lives. And coloring it in ways that are actually unfortunate for everybody else and for us, and blaming some other factors that have actually nothing to do with it. And missing what's deepest and best, perhaps most beautiful. So, is it possible to actually have a meditation where the breath is really boring? Like, and it doesn't feel like delicious. I don't see why that couldn't be as successful a meditation as the other, as long as you're aware of the boredom. And then you have to ask yourself, I guess, don't you, who is bored here? And you can even do a little experiment, which I sometimes recommend to people who are really bored. Does anybody feel bored during this breathing meditation? It would be fine if you were. Please raise your hand if you had even a moment of, good God, this is. So here, if you do a little yogic exercise where you find the breath to be unbelievably boring, you take your thumb and push it over this nostril. Take your middle finger and put it on the bridge, or your index finger and put it on the bridge of your nose. You take your middle finger and you squeeze it over this nostril, and you keep your lips pressed together, and you see just how long it takes for the next in-breath to become exquisite. And what's interesting is who's and I love it, and I'm successful at it. And the reason I'm, you know, separating on this, it's not at your expense, it's that we're all wired up the same. So, would you agree this is something that's speaking to you?
Yes.
They're beautiful. And I'm very happy also that you've had this experience. Because something brought you here. You had a miserable, boring experience of breathing, and yet you came for 2 more days. And that's why sometimes it's important to leaven it with a certain degree of irreverence, with a certain degree of humor and lightness, if you will. Because we're really talking about life and death here. It's not so much like, is the breath boring, or is the breath delicious, or do I feel all of a sudden happy, and then do I scare myself because I feel so happy, maybe I'll lose my mind. It's all of which could come up in the mind. But we're talking about the actual heart of living beings. So I won't hold you up there for the microphone anymore. Except to ask, is there anything that more that you'd like to say at this moment?
Just looking forward to the next couple of days.
Thank you. Well, you know, when we start in the classes in MBSR, how many of you have been through either an NBC class or an MBA class?
What's my class?
Did you all at some point encounter a racing?
Yes.
People's faces light up. Oh, yes. I thought about it and decided not to bring racings today. I saw a bumper sticker once like that. I had a racing with John Kennison. Someone once gave me sterling silver cufflinks in the shape of raisins. So all of a sudden, like, I'm getting reified as a raisin. But one of the things that people say after they have experienced the raisin is eating meditation. One raisin. One of the infinite number of really wonderful things that people say is that they see the whole world in the raisin. And by the same token, and it's so rich, and it starts to unpack in just the way that we started talking about your experience of a successful, your delicious breath. And all of a sudden, like, you've got your whole life in that raisin. We're in that breath. It's like, oh yeah, and I do this habitually, and I do that habitually, and I don't taste my food, or whatever it is. And it's like, and I don't taste my relationships with people. And I'm always on to the next bite before I have the first bite. And all of a sudden, like, you get your whole life out of one breath. I find that very interesting. You can also get it out of one breath. Out of one moment. This is one of the beauties of this work. I mean, people say, why do you do this work? And it's like, well, I just haven't found anything else on the planet that's as powerful. If I had, I'd be doing that. I don't have any kind of loyalty to mindfulness. It's like a you know, sort of a professional field. It's just like, I mean, it's just as I said a bit last night, you know, just a little bit, but fascinated with power and the potential for of a certain kind of awareness that we never get any instruction in, even though it's part of our repertoire. So, when we begin to investigate our experience in this kind of a way, and interrogate it, so to speak, without the cognitive piece being predominant, but not meta mind, but it's still here, I mean, thinking is really important and wonderfully brilliant that we have the capacity to think. But wouldn't you say a lot of time gets us into trouble? I mean, it's just like take sleep for a seeing the thing the next day, really tired, I'm jet lagged, but you know, so it's maybe on my mind. But you know, with stress, I mean, the first thing that goes is sleep. And a lot of the time, you get into sleep, you really need to sleep. You've got a big deal to happen the next day, whatever it is. You're going to be caught in front of people that are terrifying. And you lie there and just feeling like sleep. And then some little thought secretes itself in your mind. Just one tiny little thought. And you know you're not going to get sleep paralysis. Sure, because that thought leads to another thing. It's like, you know, so thoughts can be incredibly tyrannizing. And it can be incredibly insightful. I mean, Nobel Prize winning insight. And everything in between. Einstein said once that, you know, if you have one or two good thoughts in your life, you're lucky. That was Einstein. So if you haven't said that over all of us, it's probably, if one of us had one good thought in, you know, among 10,000 of us, we're lucky. So a lot of the time we privilege thought and then actually mistake it, mis-take it for reality. What we think is the way it is. It's like almost never the case. Whereas there are other forms of intelligence, awareness being one, somatic intelligence, hearing intelligence, seeing intelligence, that's kind of before thinking sets in, before it gets clothed in words and explanations. That's kind of what the Zen people call original mind. Original mind. If I take these bells, for instance, do whatever I want out there. There are certain laws, because otherwise society would not function. Property managers go in the United States. Property and that. That was the law. 100 years ago, this is like, you know, Oxford is like, I don't know, 1500 years old. Do you hear what I'm saying? I mean, the human species is a work in progress. And it is, in some sense, hopefully, progressing in the directions of greater harmony, of greater wisdom, of less harmony. But we got to, you know, our work cut out for us. Any other comments? Last comment about the... Yeah, please.
I've been meditating mindfully for about 3 years now, and use it in my practice as well, with clients. My question was about the difference in the experience today as opposed to the experience at home. That's something that clients often comment on as well. That I noticed that I was instantly in my body and just be, as opposed to at home, it is far more difficult to create that space instantly for myself. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to counter that, because it has nothing to do with being here with you or being here with a number of people. It is just being in a space that is just for meditation.
Thank you for bringing that up. I'm really delighted that you're bringing that up. And also delighted that you're saying it has nothing to do with me. Or with the 250 other people. Sometimes it does. You know, the setting makes a difference and the intention. Is, you know, one of the powerful things about mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is that we're not doing it by ourselves. We're doing it together. People will often say, I find it much more easy to meditate in the class than to do at home. But I hear you saying, not quite that. But that, not quite. Because there's, that may be true, but there's something else.
Yes.
And what is the something? Could it be a little bit more?
I think the something else is that it's part of a day in which I'm working, I'm doing. I'm a human doing in other ways.
I get it. I hear it.
And then I have to come to being.
Okay. Who says? You said I have to come to being. So who says you have
to? I won't.
Okay, so you don't have to. Okay, so it's a choice. Yes. This will be a theme throughout the next 2 days. It's something about choosing that is very, very important. So let's just kind of keep that mode out there, the kind of notion that there's something about choosing that's important. Okay. And I feel like the more some of the elements that I'll be voicing over the next 2 days are introduced at the very, very beginning moments of one's coming to the meditation practice. It can be very helpful. One of them is that I mentioned it before, is that there's no separation between life and mindfulness. So there is a certain way in which taking your seat is kind of artificial, and if you're doing it in the middle of the workday, there's lots of distractions and energy, and that is a sort of transition out of doing into being and back into doing. And it can be very agitated, and I feel the same way as what you said about this morning, where like this is kind of time devoted to it, and somehow you just dropped in, and it wasn't because of me, it wasn't because of us, it was because of something in yourself. That's wonderful to be aware of. That something in yourself is probably always available to you. Always available to you. And you may be creating a certain kind of cognitive framework with the now I'm meditating, now I'm not, that may make it difficult to feel like, you know, this is okay, my experience is okay like this, because it's not the way it's supposed to be when I'm really calm. Or something like that. Is this, are you following me? Is this making sense or not?
It makes sense, but I don't come to the meditation with the thought that it's going to make me calm.
Okay.
I just take myself to the meditation.
And how can, and but you accept it as it is?
Yeah.
All right. But you're noticing it's not as, and then you want to use the word like deep or something. Not as what?
I felt more centered instantly,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
More centered instantly, but it still comes when you're doing it.
At some stage, yes. But it varies from day to day.
Yeah, right, okay. So I guess what I'm suggesting is that it's good to note, but it's also important to actually allow yourself to have it be very many, many different ways. And to just keep on coming back to the practice, allowing it to be as it is. So some days are like unbelievably distracted. You know, meditating, say, in an airport. It's like potentially like lots of distractions, especially since you don't want to go too deeply into stillness because then you may miss your flight. So you have to be aware of a lot of different that kind of situation at work. What I'm basically driving at is that we be as gentle as possible with ourselves and not hold up any standard of how it should be. So that after 2 days of sitting together like this and you go back to work, don't expect either that it will be like it is here or that it won't be like it is here. Because you just don't know. But the more you're willing to sit in a way that's outside of time, and that you no longer even consider to be meditating, I suggest that we just throw out the word, or the thought, at least, I meditate. And just sit. The Japanese actually call, you know, one of their practices in Zen, which we'll come to a bit later, but that has to do with objectless attending, not featuring any object. They call it Shikan Taza, which translates as just sitting, nothing more. Well, just sitting turns out to be very challenging. Just sitting, because there's always something more. You hear what I'm saying? So, to be as gentle with yourself and as spacious around the question of should you be feeling a certain way. Now, I don't want to create, you know, a space between us artificially, because I don't actually hear you saying that you should be feeling a certain way. You're just noting that it's one way, and you were asking me about, well, but it doesn't feel this way at work, and you're wondering, maybe you're wondering, well, why? So, well, I don't know, but it doesn't have to feel any one way. And another really important thing to hear from the beginning is there's no one right way to practice. It's there are an infinite number of ways to enter into your own life. And the really important thing is to enter, not which door you come into. And so a more spacious invitation to yourself about what this really is about from the very beginning can actually avoid some of those things. And then others of it, it's just like years and years and years and years and years of inhabiting awareness to one degree or another, you get to know the territory a lot better. And as with anything, and in a certain sense, the greater the degree of comfort, the greater the degree of at-homeness, and that has an influence over the quality of your presence in the midst of, say, moments when it's very complicated, when lots of different things are happening at once, and sometimes the proverbial stuff is hitting the proverbial fan. And it's not like, oh, well, this is preventing you from having a good meditation because we have some ideal of how my meditation should be. This is the meditation, the proverbial stuff hitting the proverbial fan. How am I to be in relationship to this? And it may not be, I'll just sit there and I will will say that, you know, just one thing, and that is that for those of you who were here last night, but I talked about that mindfulness, the number of papers on the subject of mindfulness in the scientific and medical literature is going exponential. I didn't speak about why it's going exponential, and I don't think anybody knows, but I think that one of the reasons that it's going exponential, at least in the field of psychology, because most of you are in therapy and psychology, and promoted by the Oxford Center for Cognitive Therapy and the Oxford Mindfulness Center. See, but MBSR, really the major focus is on medicine. And psychology and psychiatry were kind of involved, but they were in some sense ancillary. But when mindfulness-based cognitive therapy evolved and developed, then all of a sudden, because of the three people who were responsible for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and their relationship to the world of cognitive therapy, all of a sudden, psychology got into mindfulness in a very, very big way. Maybe it was ready, maybe it was right. And there, of course, there are other streams. There's like Marshall Linehan's work, which I bow to with infinite respect and gratitude, and I love her as a friend. And the act, you know, about C.K. Hayes' stuff. But I think that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is one very, the development of it really gave rise after Mark and Zingel and John published their book to a whole element of that exponential rise. There were others like the mindfulness scales that work to measure mindfulness, which, you know, and also the fact that we can now use scanners to look in real time at people who are meditating. So now there are these studies of, you know, monks and meditators, people who've been meditating for more hours than you and I ever been log on this planet, and to look at how their brains are and to expand the field of neuroscience by understanding that, you know, if you do this for years and years and years, you actually change the structure and function of your brain. But it turns out if you do it even for 8 weeks in MBSR, you change in certain potentially really important ways, certain aspects of the brain that are really important. So I just want to say that we're at a very, very precious time. And I think that one of the reasons that there are 250 people in the room, 250 people on the waiting list, is that this time is pregnant with tremendous transformative possibility for the field of psychotherapy, for the field of psychiatry, for the field of psychology. And that there's a very, very high risk that that promise and that potential and that pregnancy will actually be unfulfilled if it's not understood at the deepest of levels what that potential promise is. And it can only be understood by our willingness to actually drop into it ourselves, as opposed to think of it as some kind of cognitive structure where mindfulness is now one more concept that we just put into our bag of concepts. And of course, if you have a PhD or some kind of, you know, credential in psychology, it's like, of course I'm mindful, I'm in the present moment, and I am non-judgmental, and, you know, and stuff. And it's true to a degree, but it's also not true to a degree. And the problem is that the mindfulness or the non-judgmental is the I that's claiming some kind of I to that. You know what I'm saying? There's a danger here that the transformative, really profound importance of this could actually be denatured or stillborn if we individually don't take responsibility for understanding that, humbling as it is, because mostly when you practice mindfulness, what you see is how mindless we are. To actually embrace that with a huge amount of self-compassion and heart, and stay with the practice as the fundamental vector of transformation. And out of that will come enormous intellectual potential. Enormous potential. So the more MBCT or MBSR is not really MBCT or not really MBSR because the teachers don't really understand it from the inside and aren't sort of not coming too much from a cognitive sort of conceptual perspective and framework, then the studies, the science that is done will actually be poor science because it will be claimed to be MBSR, but it won't even know what MBSR is or MBCT. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's another reason why I feel tremendous gratitude that you're all here today and that I'm not getting the feeling like you have no idea what I'm talking about. Can you feel like we're in some kind of collective mind, heart space where we're actually sharing something that probably there's a huge amount of consilience and consensus? And also, how powerful the promise is, and also how easy it would be to actually turn it into one more thing, because we need the one more thing to feel confident, to feel more than confident, or to, you know, whatever it is that is promoting the I, me, mine, personal pronoun love affair, can actually include what's underneath the I mean mine, and who is speaking when we say I? Who is it that's claiming this, that, or the other? And then we can, it strikes me just off the top of my head that the more we can ask that kind of question, the more honest we'll be, because there's no difference between honesty and asking that question. Not knowing who actually is bored with the breath and who is actually feeling the breath as delicious. Is it this person? Is it the same? I will say, I hate this, I love this. Or are they different competing sub-elements of, you know, what we consider to be personality, but underneath it there's a sort of much bigger being that we don't really have language for. But that, you know, is more resonant with awareness that we don't ever identify with. Think of ourselves as awareness and say, who are you? And I say, I'm John Edison. And we usually hit the body. And we talk about my body, John's body. I have a body. That's weird. Who is it that has the body? When we use the personal pronoun I, how do we talk about it? My body. My ideas. My opinions. My career, my success, my happiness. And have you ever had, even on a meeting level, the experience of like getting what you want, still not being happy? Anybody have that experience? Or is it just me? I think there was a great British rock group that I really had something to say about that. Still alive.
Okay, so let's, for now, let's just take the chairs and put them against the